Joe, how you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim, and I'm not engaged in any illegal acts of discrimination as far as I can tell as I sit here. So we had talked about discussing the anti-discrimination laws, which are certainly powerful here in America. What's your take on them? Give us a synopsis and some wisdom regarding all of this stuff.
Excuse me. Yeah, what got me thinking about this was the recent Supreme Court ruling, Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission. This was a case for the Supreme Court that deals with whether owners of a public accommodations can refuse certain services based on the First Amendment claims of free speech and free exercise of religion, and hence given the exemption from the laws ensuring non-discrimination in public accommodations. Excuse me. In particular, by refusing to provide creative services such as certain wedding custom wedding cakes for marriages of same-sex couples. Excuse me. The case dealt with Masterpiece Cake Shop, a bakery in Lakewood, Colorado, which refused to provide a wedding cake to a gay couple based on the owner's religious beliefs. The Colorado Civil Rights Commission, in evaluating the case under the anti-discrimination law, found the bakery discriminated against the couple and issued specific orders for the bakery to follow. Following the appeals within the state that affirmed the commission's decisions, the bakery took the case to the Supreme Court. The High Court ruled on narrow grounds in a 7-2 decision that the commission did not employ religious neutrality, violating Masterpiece owner Jack Phillips' rights to free exercise, and reversed the commission's decision. The court did not rule, the court did not rule on the baker's intersection of anti-discrimination laws, free exercise of religion, and freedom of speech due to the complications of the commission's lack of religious neutrality. The court seemed to find that there was bias in the state government in favor of same-sex marriages, pointing out the commission ruled against Phillips in part on the theory that any messages on the requested cake would be attributed to the customer and not the baker, therefore wasn't a free speech or a free exercise case. But the court ruled the court found the state's interest in banning LGBTQ. Didn't want to leave anyone out. Discrimination could have been weighed against Phillips' sincere religious objections in a way consistent with the requisite religious neutrality that must be strictly observed. The state's commission did not do that because it showed signs of hostility in the court's view towards Phillips and his religious beliefs. So the state could, in theory, prevent discrimination like Phillips, but it has to do it in a way that respects people's religious beliefs, which the court concluded the commission did not do here. Of course, in my view, this... a simple solution would have been find another bakery, avoid all the problems. But this raises the point here of anti-discrimination law, and the history of it, of anti-discrimination laws, date back to at least the question of their constitutionality and their legality date back to 1896 in the Plessy versus Ferguson case. This is the case that created the separate but equal doctrine, and it lasted until 1954, until Brown versus Board of Education. Basically, it said that segregation was not illegal or unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment, because as long as you had separate accommodations, there was no, violation of equal protection of the law. This was seen to be correct based on the original intent of the of the Constitution, at least of the 14th Amendment, which in itself was problematic from a constitutional standpoint. But the idea that segregation was a violation of fundamental law, a violation of the Constitution, cannot be found within the law itself, because the very Congress that created the 14th Amendment actually created segregated schools in Washington, D.C., so it can't be found within the original intent of that law. So how was it found to be unconstitutional? Well, what happened was it's something called modern authority in constitutional law by the courts. And basically, it evolved. Their interpretation of the Constitution evolved, and up until the 1950s, when it became, I guess, a progressive cause to support desegregation and integration. And this is this 1954 case, Brown versus School Board of Topeka, Kansas. The court declared didn't really say that segregation was in itself unconstitutional. What it said was, or at least it didn't reject separate but equal. It didn't want to reject the court because of the stare decisis. They didn't want to undermine the legitimacy of the court. So what the court found a interesting trick. What they did decide was that separate but equal isn't necessarily unconstitutional. But the only problem is that separation, the way it's implemented, is always unequal. And therefore, a violation of the 14th Amendment, and they ruled that the segregated schools, I guess, in the Topeka, Kansas, the school were unconstitutional, and they ordered the schools to begin integration with all deliberate speed. Of course, this ruling itself wasn't so much found in the law itself; it was more based on sociology, and this goes back to things like the American Dilemma, Gunnar Myrdal's book, where it found that America was irredeemably racist, and you couldn't rely on the legislative or political process to resolve this thing. They had to rely on the courts invoking modern authority, basically judges invoking higher authority to engage in social engineering. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you cut out for a few seconds, but when you came back with social engineering.
Okay, and this is that famous Dahl test that basically the court ruled that there basically segregation created a feeling of inferiority among black students. Based on the fact that they did these series of doll tests, and black kids were picking white dolls over black dolls, and they found this was a product of segregation, and this proved that schools had to be desegregated, and this sort of developed into the 1950s. And then you have these subsequent rulings after this in the 1960s. Of course, you have the 1964 Civil Rights Act, Title VI and Title VII, which make racial discrimination illegal. Title VI, more or less, in public accommodations, and Title VII, in private accommodations or businesses that have, I guess, are open to the public. And so this is how this evolved. Now, of course, we grew out of the Civil Rights Act. The Civil Rights Act actually had explicit prohibition of affirmative action or racial quotas or goals in these things. But basically, affirmative action or hiring racial quotas, the word I'm looking for, grew out of the fact how it's enforced, because basically you could ban racial discrimination and hiring in these things, but how do you enforce it? No one's gonna explicitly say we're not hiring black people. So what they did was they fell on the fact that any statistical disparity had to be a result of racial discrimination, and that was a prima facie case of racial discrimination. And of course, this made businesses presumed to be guilty in such cases and open to subsequent costly litigation. And so businesses themselves would invoke racial quotas to shield themselves legally. And thus, what happened was you had this. Particularly in government contracts, like 60,000 companies nationwide, are a recipient of federal contracts, and in order to comply to get those contracts, they have to establish racial quotas, meet these timetables. So that's how we have this era of racial quotas. But that's kind of a brief history of anti-discrimination laws. The criticism of it is that these laws themselves have sort of evolved into a reverse racism. We have these racial quotas. Also, it's also a violation of voluntary contract and voluntary association. So that's kind of I tried to do a brief summation of this. So where do you want to go with that?
Well, God only knows, Tim, where do you go with it? It's It's a summation of something that's very difficult to describe because basically the process is on one hand insane, and in another hand it's just a pack of lies, and so you've got
Hey, Joe.
basically cover narratives that are pretty weak, that are.
Hey, Joe.
Can you hear me,
Yeah, you're a little choppy. Should
Tim?
I try to
I've
give you a
lost
call?
you, buddy.
Let
Yes,
me
sir.
just try to give you a call back.
Yeah, you're choppy.
Okay.
Twice it all in. I'll
Start.
just say that the anti-discrimination laws are actually the legal implementation of the goals of the cultural Marxist. If you look at the formation of, for example, the cult of integration with Martin Luther King, we've done a show on that. We show its connection into Freemasonry and the deep state. We've done the same thing with Gloria Steinem and feminism, showing her background in the CIA, and you can just go down a long list of social programs and the sex, drugs, and rock and roll, the counterculture, whereby the goals of the cultural Marxists are implemented through these social actions. Well, the anti-discrimination laws are simply the legal structure to implement the goals of the cultural Marxists. And so, what are the goals? Well, basically, it is to atomize the family and to blank out the ethnic and intellectual identity of the citizens. All right. So this is the process that they're involved with. Race was the first, focus. It was the easiest to do, but you were just absolutely positive. You could be guaranteed that you were going to get into sex and into education and into the family and all these other structures as soon as possible because they're all part of the same goal. And so what I wanted to do, if it's okay, is just to give a not too lengthy description of all of the things that led up to where now in the local grammar school, you have restrooms that are now designated all gender. That's the actual title they have. Boys and girls are gone. The restrooms are titled all gender. And of course, that means they're not just two genders anymore, Tim. There's just a whole bunch of genders. So why have we come down this path? I mean, what led us? It just seems insane, right? And it is in a certain sense, but actually what we're dealing with is just an attack. This is just an attempt to destroy the intellect of and the soul of the European. That's really what you're experiencing when you get into these anti-discrimination laws and what's really in back of them. The fact that sexuality has become basically unregulatable, right? It just goes on forever. Any kind of sex, any kind of gender, it's all just amorphous. These are all what they're trying to do is get to the point where there isn't any identifiable self. That's really exactly what they want to achieve because that is what they have called in the past class consciousness. We'll get into this, where they have specifically targeted basically the identity of the European as the goal of the whole cultural and legal process that they want to go through and achieve. And it actually, there's different places you could start. I mean, we could go to Shakespeare, but I was just going to start it as to just to give like a you know a person who's coming into these ideas for the first time, just a sort of a primer on it. It actually is easy to start up from the book that Marx and Engels created called The Origin of the Family, which was published in 1884, but was actually the first book they ever wrote. A lot of people think it was, a book on economics. That's not true. The first book they actually wrote was this thing called The Origin of the Family, which kind of is actually a blueprint for what then follows. And I'll just read the general purpose of it. This is Engels' own words. Actually, he edited it, but Marx evidently had written the first draft, and then Engels edited it, and it became published after Marx had died. But it's regarded that everyone accepts the fact that it's their first work. So he said that Engels said that we needed to abolish all right of inheritance and home and religious education, to dissolve monogamy in marriage, to pursue pre and extramarital sex, to foster and tolerate the gradual growth of unconstrained sexual intercourse by unmarried women, to nationalize all housework, to shift mothers into factories, to move children into daycare centers. Engels wrote that the single family ceases to be an economic unit of society. Private housekeeping is transformed into a social industry. The care and education of the children becomes a public affair. Society looks after all children alike, whether or not they are legitimate. Now, you know, well, what is the just sort of the reason that you'd want to take, you know, the people into this situation? They saw the family in their argument. They said, well, it's because the family is basically reflects the system of oppression. So in other words, they claim that there is a system of oppression that the family is basically reflecting, and it's not just the family, but the individuals inside the family, their identity, their very self-awareness is a reflection of this oppression. And in order to get to the workers' paradise, we have to basically create class consciousness. Now, class consciousness is basically the goal of the anti-discrimination laws. In other words, there is no more ethnicity that is a basis for the ability and desire to have interaction, you know, the control over interactions with people based on preference. I mean, that's all gone. Gender is not part of class consciousness. And of course, sexuality is unbridled. There's no restriction because the family is gone. And obviously, to reduce the tension, you want to keep the slaves pacified. So and then, of course, as you go out into the alphabet soup gender, you are getting further and further from the uniquely structured self. Do you see what I mean? In other words, there is no real gender, there is no real sexuality. There is no real family. There is no real ethnicity. And so, anti-discrimination, feminism, and of course all the protections of the protected class of the GBTL stuff, this is all just these are all the elements of the creation of what can be called class consciousness. So that was written in 1884. In 1919 it actually became real. You had a lot of this go on during the Bolshevik situation in Russia, but the kind of the writings of Lenin and the cultural ministers was scrubbed. So at least I haven't been able to get a whole lot of it that's relating to these events, the way that they were manipulating gender and sexuality. But of course, they're as well known they were trying it. But in Hungary, we actually have documents, and that's why I just wanted to just real quickly. I know I've done this before. Our listeners may be bored with it, but basically, in Hungary, you had a Bolshevik fraction gain control, and there were four individuals. There was Bela Kun, Gregory Luchas, Sigmund Kunfi, and Bela Balza. Now, that's not their real names. Actually, it's Bela Kun. It's Gregory Loewinger, it's Sigmund Kohn, and it's Herbert Bauer. They were all Jews, and so they changed their names to Hungarian names, all four of them. Amazing. It's like what's that movie, A Young Frankenstein, where the guy goes, he says Frankenstein, and he goes, no, Frankenstein. it's like, wait a second. How come all these guys changed their name? Well, they did, and so you don't have some of the understanding of what is looks to me like you have a bit of ethnic warfare, right? Bella Cohn was, or Kuhn, Frankenstein. He was also a huge Freemason, big muckamuck in the Masons. So you have, the, again, like we've talked about this connection between the Masons and elite intellectual and banking class Jews. And, of course, Gregory Luchas, his father was a baron, had the largest bank in Hungary. But anyway, this group took over. They seized control. They got control of Hungary, and they implemented basically what we can now see is being implemented in all of the countries in the West. They did it overnight, and they wrote about it. Thank heavens, because I think this is really, really important stuff for people to understand. So they became, well, Luchas became the Kamizat of public education. And so he then, he wrote that, he says, you know, to create the new economic order, we need a new man. And the name today is of the new man is a child. So they implement on the education side a completely a sexual structure similar to the one that Marx and Engels had had described. I mean, they just said forget about marriage. They encouraged homosexuality. They encouraged pubescent sexual activity. They just said, go for it. It's fun. It's good. Don't have an identity of a family person. You know, this bourgeois identity of family is bad. Women are property, and we're looking for a class consciousness. So the sexuality was really degenerate. But what's important is that they also then took 120,000 proletariat children, and they would... they would read them fairy tales, very particular kinds of fairy tales, every afternoon. It was just this practice that they actually wrote that, and this is Luchas or Lohan or Belas, which is Cohn, and they produced this document, and they said, you know, everything is possible for everyone in accord with inner worth, where the characters change not only their class, but also their form and their life. They're talking about the fairy tales. Such a world is more communist than our communism. We abolished only the differences between human classes, right? With the possibility provided by enchantment, the fairy tale erased the border between animal, vegetable, and human being. Between every existing and non-existing being. Okay, so now here, that's truly anti-discriminatory, isn't it, Tim? I mean, you see what I mean? You've got really solid anti-discrimination here because you're not even, your identity is not even detecting these bourgeois differences between being an animal or a vegetable. Now, this is really important because this is their language. They're describing what they're doing. And so to me, that will, you know, kind of takes people to like basically, you know, an intellectual world that they can make sense of what is going on now. Because when you go into I actually have like, you know, another whole piece here. But what I want to talk about now is like, okay, so you have then after the Hungarian Revolution collapses, you have the structure of the Frankfurt School, which then gets into our legal system. And in the Frankfurt School, once again, you had this group, because the Frankfurt School, which then becomes basically the American Jewish Committee, and they created the authoritarian personality, which is one of the frameworks for all of the laws that we're now seeing, but they also created literature so that you can actually see that in their literature that they're talking very specifically about the destruction of the individual, and they talk about how they're going to do it, how they're going to actually change laws, and they're going to use this thing called critical theory, right? Which is related to class consciousness, that it's the critique of everything. And so basically what they're going to do is they're going to take the attributes of a culture which are positive and then create a dialectic. So in other words, if you want to promote in your culture the free market, say, they will then talk, they say, okay, well, the contradiction to that would be exploitation, right? So in other words, with critical theory, it doesn't matter what's good about a culture, they will produce the opposite. So it's just a never-ending process, basically, of establishing what I would call intimidation, right? They are basically shattering the ability to, if you say individual freedom, they will talk about, well, social inequality. If you say, well, it's a free market produces good thing, they'll say, no, exploitation, right? This is how they describe the critique of political economy and the critique of culture. So this then becomes the anti-discrimination laws, which are designed to basically end the identity of self and the identity of ethnicity. If you look at, you know, go back from the anti-discrimination laws to the authoritarian personality, what's interesting is that, you know, they were doing all kinds of sophistry. They're pretending to be scientific, but they're just coming up ways to basically control, you know, to place themselves in a position of control over culture and government. But, you know, people say, well, there was the Holocaust. You know, we've done shows on that. But, you know, that is sort of a justification for, you know, their claiming to have the moral authority to use propaganda, which is to say mind control, brainwashing. They claim this authority. But in fact, when you look at how the authoritarian personality structures itself, it only really has one chapter on anti-Semitism, but it has five chapters on ethnocentrism. You see, this is really what they were trying to get at. They were trying to find ways to break down the sense of ethnicity that the Europeans had. This is really, it just comes right through when you get to the conclusion, chapter 23, where they actually talk about, you know, okay, we've got to use propaganda. So now when you go forward and you look at political correctness and how it is, you know, such an unassailable political force in our culture, and then see how it supports the laws, right? You see how the religion of integration is basically a religion. You know, you can't do something that's racism, like demand that you have your own little ethnicity. You look at feminism, right? You'd like to stand up to Gloria Steinem, but you can't do that because this would be, you know, basically a mental illness, right? And so when you look at the protected groups, right, that they have established legally, you have these legally protected groups under these you know, anti-discrimination laws, you are basically trying to expand out the sense of self to include basically everything. This is the process that in the Hungarian Revolution was, you couldn't tell the difference between, you know, animal and vegetable. Well, when you get to basically the gender perspective now of like polygender, you know, like where you're almost to the point where you've reached the end of the road of animalism, and you're getting close to just a class consciousness where you really don't have even kind of a bourgeois concept of humanity. So the whole point I'm trying to make is that, look, Marx had, you know, some economic fluff that, you know, makes no sense in hindsight, is just completely ridiculous, but it was done to create the political control which a lot of people could be liquidated. They were told there's going to be workers' paradise. They gave up their political control to the Bolsheviks, and then the next thing you know, there's 100 million people dead. In the United States, you have the cultural Marxists, and they've come in and they now are promising that there's going to be this better world, you know, where once they get rid of ethnicity, where the white male privilege is gone, you're going to have egalitarianism, and then it won't be a slave camp. It's going to be paradise on earth. Well, this has about as much chance as the Russian peasants had. I mean, you're headed directly for a slave camp, because the whole point is with class consciousness is that now you have the culture, the population at a point where they will simply obey a single person and they'll do anything. And so that's the now bear in mind that's, you know, it's incrementalism. You start out with, you know, like with feminism as you know, you have these very benign or seemingly logical, economically fair issues, but it's going to expand as you go forward. And so we started out, you know, you have Plessy and then, you know, Brown v. and then all of the seemingly reasonable kind of, you don't want to affirmatively do negative things toward people just because of their color. But then the freedom of association suddenly is on the block. And then, you know, it isn't just schools, then it gets into the workplace, into the military, you know, it becomes everywhere. And now basically with the obvious expansion into sexuality, you're moving the identity of the citizen into complete abstraction, where there isn't gender, there isn't ethnicity, there isn't economic reality, you know, there's no free market that you basically can compete in and win. I mean, what you've got is a class consciousness, which is the same consciousness that way back when in 1919 was being envisioned, where you couldn't tell the difference between, you know, being a human being and an animal.
Yeah, this idea of, again, leveling everything, the assumption that the natural order is equal, we're all equal, therefore there should be equal results, equal participation, and the only problem is that contradicts the idea of freedom, because of people are free to participate, they're going to have different results between men and women, even between ethnic groups, because there's just certain proclivities, certain traits that express themselves differently, and this is also a cultural thing, things change over time. But with the Civil Rights Act, you had, of course, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was the became the legislative basis for affirmative action, and created things like the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and other federal agencies to enforce these things. Inspector General offices, Inspector General's office, Office of Contract Compliance, and these things. What you really had, again, it's very incremental. Again, this is all because they're trying to supposedly create equality, and who can oppose equal opportunity and you know, full participation in society in these things? But you have Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, that states no person in the U.S. shall, on the grounds of race, color, or national origin, be excluded from participation in, be denied to benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any program receiving federal financial assistance. Sounds pretty good. Who can be against that? Then you have, it gets more difficult with Title VII. Title VII extends this provision by banning discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, and national origin in trade unions, employment agencies, and all other enterprises with more than 15 employees engaged in interstate commerce. Or business with federal government. Now what they do is, there's a problem here, because it really is, the federal government has no authority to step in and govern the hiring practices of these businesses. So they invoke interstate commerce as sort of a catch-all. But basically, it destroys the idea of enumerated and limited powers. They just invoke interstate commerce or general welfare. They can do whatever they want. What happens is, of course, this makes all, like I mentioned earlier, too, this makes businesses and federal contractors pretty much implement racial quotas. So basically, you have inequality law reimposed. Good example, you mentioned the special protected class. So under the name of equality, you now have a special protected class. So what that means is, when a member of a special protected class brings litigation, the defendant in that case is presumed to be guilty, in that, more or less. And so that's that. So all of a sudden you have this contradiction, Orwellian thing, where in the name of equality, people are treated unequally. The Title VII, of course, became the basis for various anti-discrimination laws and regulations. Of course, this also immensely increased the power of the state, particularly the federal government, and reduced correspondingly the contractual freedom of individuals and businesses and of the states. Now, the problem here is equality. Because I mentioned earlier, it was presumed that all inequality is a result of racial discrimination. Now, that's a rather crude way to look at these things. It doesn't really hold much out for nuance or complexity, because individuals aren't equal, and nor are groups across the board. They have different participation in different things, whether it's, you know, having more black basketball player and jazz musicians than Asians, or having more Asian classical musicians or physicists. It's just one of those things. And who's to say what's the result, what brings about that inequality? But nevertheless, it's largely an expression of nature, and no one really can really understand what brings about those inequalities, or if they're a bad thing. I would say that's real diversity, actually. And who's to say that there should be more black physicists and more Asian basketball players? I mean, who's playing God there? But nevertheless, all these laws were created, and they're very, very troubling, and they create a lot of problems. One thing is would be the 1974 Equal Credit Opportunity Act, where the government again views statistical disparity as a prima facie evidence of discrimination, despite the fact that different ethnic groups have different levels of income, different savings rates, different credit ratings and these things. So who's to say this should be a completely equal, you know, representation, and who gets loans and who doesn't? And of course, you have deservedly so maligned Community Reinvestment Act, where the federal government made banks more or less hand out unsound loans on the basis of racial criteria. Again, the way the feds enforced this was the Federal Reserve actually rate banks on how many minority loans they gave out, and this would affect whether or not banks were able to merge and acquire other banks and these things. So the banks would more or less take a hit in handing out bad loans in order to get these high scores from the Federal Reserve Bank or from the Department of Justice. Nevertheless, this again creates a lot of bad lending practices and these things, and this has a heart, contributed, not wasn't a big part of it, but it did contribute to the housing bust a few years ago, because you have a lot of bad loans being written out. You have the Federal Compliance Office for Contracts, which again enforces these racial quotas. But what I'm getting at is that the reality is that groups aren't equal. So
right.
Using the law to try to enforce this is just doing more harm, and it's just all social engineering, creating a lot of bitterness between the ethnic groups, the opposite of what supposedly these laws are supposed to do. But your focus on when you're talking about how back in Hungary they focused on education. It is interesting that the first examples of the federal government enforcing integration was, of course, in the public school system, the compulsory public education system, and how they're using the schools to socially engineer these things, supposedly to raise blacks up, give them an opportunity. But if you look at, achievement, academic achievement, it actually has gotten worse since integration. And actually, these schools, because of these integration policies, because of white flight, something that was desired, by the way. Integration in these neighborhoods, actually the schools have gotten worse, particularly in Boston in some of these cases. So everything has gotten worse. At the same time, actually it's a war on identity, because to identify ethnically now is considered, particularly if you're a white ethnicity, so-called white ethnicity, Irish, German, Polish or something, that is considered, sort of retrograde and racist. At the same time, they're still very much encouraging identity. If you're an oppressed minority, and they're creating new identities. Again, this goes back to this whole thing. The Lukács agenda was to break down any real identity so anyone can identify as anything they want. Now we have today now, where they've moved from, of course, laws against racial discrimination, which you could argue at least that's an objective basis. It's an immutable characteristic, and then they move to sex. Now, the problem with that is, I would say the differences between black and white men are nothing compared to the difference between men and women in general. And there are legitimate reasons to discriminate against men and women in employment and what they do, what type of jobs they get, because of the physical differences and the roles they serve in society. Particularly women obviously women have babies, men don't, right? That's going to profoundly affect how they participate in the workforce and the money they earn and what they should be doing. But a good example is, this is technically illegal today, but I think I can understand why an employer would do this. If you're an employer and you have a job, a vacancy, and you're interviewing candidates for that job, and along comes in a 25-year-old male who just got married, and the job requires some training, and you expect some longevity in this job, and along comes in a 23-year-old young lady who just got married, going for the same job, it will be illegal to choose the male because you might view him as more reliable because that young lady's likely to leave and to take care of her kids. That's illegal to do that. But you can see why an employer would do that, because the male, statistically speaking, the male would in the long term be a more reliable employee from the standpoint of the business concern. But that's illegal, even though it's completely legitimate, because women do tend to leave work. They tend to leave jobs 8 times more than men. Women get married, their income drops. Men get married, their income increases. And then there's reasons for this, because women have other priorities, and well, they should. They shouldn't feel guilty about it by going home and taking care of the baby. But anti-discrimination laws view that as illegal and unconstitutional. Although I have to assume it goes on every day, because employers have to make sure their businesses operate profitably. So this is part of the problem. These anti-discrimination laws it doesn't take into reality or the nuances of reality.
Yeah, I think that there is almost no chance to reverse the process if the public somehow doesn't become aware that these little areas of conflict, which in many cases, like women who are entering the workplace will, be proponents of feminism because I think they're going to benefit from them. But there has to be a widespread understanding that all of these anti-discrimination policies in total are there for one purpose, and that's to create a class slave consciousness. Mm-hmm. Now that's a hard lump for someone to get to, if they're starting out, particularly as a proponent of one of the, if you're a young black professional person, a male, you're trying to make it, you look at the affirmative action laws, you go, man, this is good stuff. It's fair. If you're a woman, you're benefiting from financially from some of these things. Well, okay. But just, you have to stop for a second and think, could any of this have been weaponized, and start to become familiar with this long-standing process that is trying to create class consciousness. And what is class consciousness? Class consciousness is the state where the identity has been evaporated. And why are they doing this? Are they doing this because they think that they're going to create this workers' paradise once they blank out the minds of all of the population? No. Look at what happens in Russia, and look at what happens in Hungary. Look at the genocide that always accompanies the so-called political power that you give to these groups who are promising these workers' paradise. And that's why, even though it's kind of a lump, I really wish that because it's sort of it is not sort of, it's very technical to get into the kind of mumbo jumbo intellectual concepts that Adorno and Horkheimer, for example, that with the stuff that they come up with. But this is things that people should be aware of, because if they could understand what they're saying, because again, like I was saying, hey, in the Soviet Union, it's very hard to get sort of the way that they were consciously attempting to evaporate the minds of the proletariat. But with Adorno and Horkheimer, you get actual documents that you can read that they are actually have as a goal the idea of basically getting rid of the autonomous individual. They want the social basis for the autonomous individual to recede into the past, and they just want basically an inability for the just like Adorno suggested that the originalist is his, where he said the original thin of thought lies in an attempt to eliminate all that is other than thought. This is an attempt by the subject to basically devour the object. It is the striving for identity. You see, the individual will strive for identity in the bourgeois society. So you try to find ways to void this out, right? This is what, if you get to the chapter 23, where they talk about how they're going to unify all of the psychological sciences, right? Psychology, sociology, the financial world. This is literally the power that is then going to create the anti-discrimination laws. And they call it propaganda. And it's going to, they say they're going to use Eros, right, as the tool of propaganda. What is this for? This is to create class consciousness, to create a state where you don't discriminate against anything or anyone. You see, all of these anti-discrimination laws.
Look how that word has become a bad word, when it's simply discrimination, just simply making a choice between one thing or another.
It's a positive thing.
Yeah.
It's a positive thing. The capacity to make discriminations is the end result of maturity.
A discriminating palate, right?
A discriminating palate, the ability to discriminate between sophistry and real reasoning. You know, when they throw critical theory at you, when you have a professor sitting there criticizing everything about European culture, right, and white male privilege, and not creating an objective format for the discussion of it, right, saying, well, of course, these things have a benefit. These things are not all bad. These things, in fact, you know, you get a lot of very good things that come about from these things. When they use the dialectic approach, where they just say, this is evil, it's bad, you're bringing it up, and therefore you're a manifestation of evil. And that's what's really the sad thing that goes on a lot of college campuses, is that the kids don't understand that they've been led to an intellectual place of basically very close to just complete slavery, where they don't have any even the ability to listen to an opposing argument. They're very close to a class consciousness.
One thing I thought was interesting, the irony of it all, the just Orwellian nature of this, is desegregation of public schools in the 50s and 60s that was done with all deliberate speed. Of course, it started out with saying we just have to desegregate. Now, desegregate is different than integrate, because you can say we're not segregated anymore. We're just going to go to the schools where you live. The only problem is communities aren't integrated yet, so the schools are de facto segregated, and this bothers the social engineers, because they have a preconceived notion that people have to mix. No, okay, why is that? They never really seem to explain that. So what they do is that then they start forcibly integrating with busing. Now, one of the original arguments against segregated schools was many black students were forced to be bused long distances to attend the black school when they could have attended a white school closer to them. Well, lo and behold, years later, whites are being bused to attend black schools to integrate. So they're experiencing the same. This is what happened in Boston in 1975. This is part of destroying those communities. And also what it does to if you're going to have a public school, you're going to have this compulsory education system itself, it's mitigated somewhat by the fact that it's locally controlled. So the people have some interest in the school. It's their district. It's their neighborhood. They'll attend school board meetings. They'll be involved in education. They'll have some control over it. And they're all of a similar ethnic group, so they'll communicate and they'll be a powerful force democratically. Well, what happens is if you create a Tower of Babel in the public schools, you don't get that anymore. then it becomes mass ethnic politics, and no one gets along, and nothing gets done, and they're easy to manipulate. Everyone's got their hand out for their piece of the pie, and this is what's happened in these schools. So I mean, again, they bring about what they claim they're trying to solve. They actually create a far worse problem. Just like how the schools are now more segregated than ever. Because what happens was when you force integration in these neighborhoods, the people who have the means leave, white flight. And really what happened, we're having this country now, is you have the people who have the financial resources, they implicitly choose to live in white neighborhoods. So they implicitly segregate anyway. They just don't want to admit it. They don't want to explicitly say we want our segregated neighbors. We're just living in an area. They'll use euphemisms like we like to go where the schools are good. You know, we like to know where there's low crime. Well, what does that mean? Come on. What that really means is you live in a homogenous, usually a white neighborhood, right?
Well,
that's the reality.
I just wanted to say, Tim, I live in an integrated community. and the median income of our African-American community is $800 million a year.
is that because your neighbors
are
Oprah? Because
we have one, and that's Oprah. And
there you go. You're very diverse.
So you can see, you know, how well. But you know, you're absolutely right. Is that these laws are not designed to help culture. As we've talked, and we have other shows where we're saying the inner cities were far more integrated before the anti-discrimination forces came into effect, because you actually had ethnic communities. Mm-hmm. So they were side by side. You had Italians and Poles and Germans, and mm-hmm. there were African Americans and Latino communities, but the communities had strength, and all of the communities have been damaged and shattered by this process. And so the destruction of social culture in the inner city is so transparent.
Well, it's kind of funny. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I just don't know how anyone can argue any longer that this wasn't the intention. It's sort of like feminism. Mm-hmm. I mean, now you have women who, you know, are approaching 50 who live alone with three cats, and they're on meds, you know, single males trying, you know, with toupee and Viagra trying to hit. I mean, the idea that, you know, family wasn't the right structure is just preposterous. We can see now that feminism was an insane idea, not just a bad idea. And this is the point, is that you can see that integration and feminism were weapons. They were not brought to us by people who actually thought at the end of the day there would be a workers' paradise. They were trying to achieve through culture what the Bolsheviks achieved through bayonets. Mm-hmm. You see, this is just the shattering of it. And then they can get these things in because of incrementalism. You know, if you look at one thing that's interesting to do, I don't know if you've ever done this, but look at how the executive order from the presidents, which basically were the way that the laws that Congress passed could be pushed into effect into the federal workplace just by executive order, right, through mm-hmm. the president. So Nixon created an executive order 11478 in 1969, and it just was the basic, you know, no discrimination on race, color, religion, or sex, right? Then you had Bill Clinton. Then he added sexual orientation, mm-hmm. and or, you know, 8-7, I believe. And then finally you have 13-672, gender identity.
Yeah. Now, so, of course, it begs the question: is why is one's sexual orientation, private behavior, an issue in the workplace? You know.
Well. It's because they're creating class consciousness. Yeah. There is no, you see, this is my point, and this is why this is just so frustrating to me, because the citizens have to stop looking at the fake dialectic. This idea, you know, like these are the issue is same-sex bathroom. Look, everyone can see same-sex bathrooms is nuts. This isn't political correctness. That's just the mask. It is class consciousness. They're atomizing even the the basic identity of sexuality, right? And as I said, in my elementary school, it has right on the bathrooms, all gender, right? Doesn't say boys, even boys and girls would be weird, but no, no, all gender.
Yeah, I was right? talking to a lady who is a teacher's assistant, and she had a troubled student, problems with discipline. And she's telling me this story, and she's talking to the father. And the father won't accept the fact that the child has behavior problems. And then at the last minute, she throws in. Says, well, I'm not too surprised by this because the kid has been adopted by two men.
Oh, God.
And I'm thinking to myself, you actually think that these problems stem from some discipline issue when that's his home life?
Well, Tim, they probably both really love the kid. Are you against love?
Yes.
Are you some kind of bigot? I mean, here you have biological structures that have been involved in evolution for billion years, right? And then you have now a culture that doesn't have even the courage to stand up for that.
Actually,
kids, dad and a mom.
It actually, because, you have a culture that encourages it. Yeah.
Exactly. You see, and so. So this is how they are creating class consciousness.
Well, I mean, you mentioned one example of the Civil Rights Act of 1968. It also is called the Fair Housing Act, because this actually put into law what was really going on for decades: the destruction of the ethnic neighbors through social engineering, through subversive means. This was overt. When housing discrimination, again, sounds great. Sounds good, but basically made it illegal for any ethnic group to protect the integrity of their ethnic neighborhood because you were racially discriminating against it. And again, this all sounds very, very progressive, but ironically, because the law was signed, I think, the week after Martin Luther King was assassinated, when the riots were going on, as if that's going to solve the problem. let's destroy the Italian and Polish neighborhoods in Chicago, because that's what you know. That's the source of racism, but again, it's the idea of destroying any ethnic identity where you can coalesce, organize. I mean, if you live in an ethnically homogenous neighborhood where people all speak the same language, and more specifically, maybe they attend the same church, and they all kind of know each other, if there's a problem, there's more of a chance that you're going to go to the next door neighbor, knock on his door, and talk about it, and organize, maybe do something about it. Whether it's a crime problem, a problem at the local school, or some, getting together to form a co-op or a farmer's market, and these things, and organizing. It's far more likely you're going to do that if you live in a community where you share the same values, obviously speak the same language, but roughly the same worldview and these things. That's obviously how that expresses itself is an ethnicity and a religion. Of course, we're talking about the ethnic neighborhoods here, which were destroyed. Of course, you live in a neighborhood, a typical suburban neighborhood, where everyone kind of keeps to themselves. They're all different religions, perhaps they're very different ethnic groups. Everyone's kind of polite, but they don't really talk to each other. They don't know each other, couldn't name their children's names if their lives depended on it. They're not going to organize and do anything, and they don't do anything to organize. They just sit back and let things happen, and they don't really organize. And really, any chance of any democratic self-rule is destroyed in that situation. We just become subjects, and that's what
absolutely.
That's what's happened.
And this, you're hit right on the head, Tim. And that's the this isn't an accidental consequence. That was the goal.
Yeah. It's been well documented. Not like we're not engaging in wild speculation. We're engaging too much speculation here. Gee, when we're dealing with secret societies, new world order, what are we supposed to do? We're not like we can file FOIA requests and find the memorandums that prove these things. It's not that simple, you know. But no, but yeah, obviously, yeah, the social engineering. This is all written up. I mean, they have books, the American Dilemma, right? These things. You have all these the programs they're instituted, the urban renewal and these things, integration to break up these neighborhoods, to create suburbia, and you know these things to create the deracinated consumer-based society we live in today, where everyone is just kind of the majority is just kind of white, and that's it. And you know, at the same time, it's funny because we talk about diversity in these things, and people always talk about the diverse other groups. There's no more diverse group than white people. you know, I'm not an identitarian. I don't think of myself as that. I'm deracinated as the next, you know, guy. But if you think about it, I mean, eye color, hair color, skin color, these things, it's very diverse. But nevertheless, it's never really treated as such. And also, globally speaking, white races are a minority, right?
Yeah. Again, this just goes to kind of the misunderstanding of history that, thank heavens, powers and principalities is here to straighten out. And, you know, one of the misunderstandings is this idea of white male privilege. I remember John Stewart, someone I dislike very much, a propagandist and a mind control individual. When Barack Obama was running for office, he was saying, I know you need to have a white male president, but you've already had 44 in a row, you know. Yeah. And you see, and he actually said Christian. Yeah, remember it was a quote, a Christian president. Well, you see, well, John,
with a name like Stewart, he must be a high Anglican or something, right?
Yeah, very high Anglican guy. And anyway, but the thing is, like Gregor Luchas and Bella Kuhn, you know, he's changed his name for some reason. Anyway, the thing is that, well, wait a second. How many of them are known Masons? How many are members of Bohemian Grove? How many attended are Skull and Bones members? You see, you have to put an asterisk against all of these purportedly Christian individuals, because frankly, if they're members of a secret society that where they're swearing oath within, you just don't have any Christianity that is similar to the stuff that's on the street that everyday European Christian Americans experience as their point of view, their perspective. They don't know who these people are from Adam. And so this is another, this white male privilege has to have an asterisk next to it, right? Because when you look at the destruction, World War II, World War I, the Civil War, you know, all of these slaughterhouses that we've been pushed into, you know, there isn't much white male privilege in any of that. So what brought that about, you see? And you see, there is a group that has privilege, but it isn't white males in general. It's a secret society. That's where the privilege lies, and that's where it's lied since the beginning of the country. So this is another way that people have been confused, right? The social justice warriors in the campuses, they have this general idea of white male privilege, but that's just a mind control term. If they actually studied it, which isn't going to happen on the campuses, of course, but if they actually did independent research, they would see that, wait a second, there is a group that has privilege, but it doesn't extend to all the white males.
No.
The white males are in just the same cultural hellhole and warfare genocide machine as everybody else, you see. So if they would have that perspective, then they could turn their attention on their controllers. They could go, well, you know, this looks real. It doesn't look like this white male privilege makes much sense historically. Maybe I'd better start to study the professors, the people who are bringing the information. Maybe they need a little scrutiny, right? Maybe there's a little privilege and bias and discrimination power inside their clique, right? Let's use a little critical theory against the professors, because frankly, they are just a lump of garbage. Okay. So this is, the rebellion that we really need. You know, one of the things we have to bring about is, you know, that people think they're benefiting from the anti-discrimination laws. No one is. We're all heading toward a slave camp, a class consciousness, where our basic humanity, because, you know, I'll tell you something, Tim, let me just tell you one thing. When the ethnic identity is done away with, they don't stop there. Look at what happened in Hungary. you lose humanity too. Even humanity is going to be in the chopping block. Right now they're trying to take care of ethnicity and sexuality. These are just the first steps. I'm telling you, they have in mind a blank, basically what they have in the future design is a blank mind.
Well, look how they've moved from racial discrimination to sex discrimination to sexual preference discrimination to sexual identity discrimination.
Exactly.
And we're getting further and further removed, and they're using that model again to forcibly integrate people and to deny people the right to discriminate. To actually choose who they want to associate with.
Well, once they get done with these things, they're going to go after consciousness itself. They're going to say, who are you to have a separate identity from the class? What kind of bigot are you? This is just the last vestige of the bourgeois racism, right?
Yeah.
Where you see yourself as something special.
Now,
you know,
the one thing I want to address is there is people listening to this will say, well, if you're against anti-discrimination laws, you must be for Jim Crow or segregation of the South on these things. Well, no, what we're saying is you have to look at the true history of this stuff. And there's been books written like this, The New Color Line by Paul Keg Roberts and Lewis Stratton talked about how actually voluntary desegregation was occurring, even in the South, just not fast enough maybe for some social engineers. One thing is, if you look at Thomas Sowell wrote a book, Men and Women's Many Books, called Civil Rights Rhetoric and Reality. And he points out all the indices of progress were improving for blacks prior to the Civil Rights era. The number of blacks going into professional fields doubled between 1954 and 1964 and stagnated after the Civil Rights Act. The same thing with the poverty rate, employment, income, education. Education was improving. After the Civil Rights, after all these measures, all these things that were done supposedly to help them, it collapsed. Look at the illegitimacy rate. When I think we talked about this last week, about the, was it might have been last week, I forget, but how when Moynihan report came out in 1965, black illegitimacy was considered catastrophic at 25%. Well, now it's close to 80%. And in the communities that are majority black communities, it's close to 100%. 100%. So it's concentrated because those blacks who can get out of those neighborhoods will go, will engage in their own white flight and go to nicer, safer communities.
Of course.
You know, everything, the Civil Rights era actually caused regression. Other than maybe these things like the Voting Rights Act or the ability to sit next to a white kid in school or something. At the same time, the social moral order is collapsing, which really hurts the poorest groups the worst because they need it the most immediately. And, of course, the same people that brought you the Civil Rights era are bringing on the Cultural Revolution, the Sexual Revolution, the media agenda, these things, Hollywood and the entertainment, the rap music and these things to corrupt the youth, to corrupt the society, which ultimately is a source of so much despair and pain because really it's not so much you're being discriminated against. The biggest problem in the black community is sexual immorality and illegitimacy that comes from that. But no one's addressing that because that's not hating whitey.
Right. And, you know, I just want to, first of all, underline your use of Thomas Sowell's statistics. I just think he's one of the clearest places to get information about inner city activity you can find. I really, you know, recommend his books. And I think that I'm very angry with him, though, because I don't think he has really been honest with his conclusions. In other words, I think he should take the position that because it's an absolute U-turn, an absolute 180 degree, all relating to a particular point where you had these anti-discrimination laws brought into effect, he should be making the case that we are making, or we try to make often, that this was done deliberately, that this isn't just bad policy. And the reason why that's important is because if people saw this, then they would realize why there wasn't ever an end of the programs. They would see them as they are as weapons, and they would feel that that they need to do something about them desperately today, because the weapons are still firing, you know, their spears into the hearts of culture everywhere that they are in place, and they're expanding. These laws are going further and further, and everywhere they do this, of course you're going to have a breakdown of moral and financial, you know, structures, because the self is being atomized.
Well, yeah, I mean, the best
people
argument.
People don't have minds anymore, you know, then the music is another component in all this. Yeah. The minds are being taken away. When you look at the counterculture, this is what's happening. They're just basically voiding the minds of the victims.
Yeah, the best argument against the Civil Rights Act, in all its titles and clauses and subclauses and all the agencies, and the best argument against the 14th Amendment is how it's been interpreted, how it's been enforced. The proof is in the pudding. We see the results. There's been regression, not progress. And the point is that we would have had a lot better progress, and maybe a slightly different direction in many ways, but there would have been greater social cohesion, more social order, less crime, and greater happiness, and freer people and healthier people, if the federal government hadn't become so activist in the after the Second World War. And really, it takes a very selective interpretation or view of history to look at the federal government as being a friend of the downtrodden, particularly if you're black. You know, because first of all, the Fugitive Slave Act was a federal law. The Supreme Court that brought down the 1856 ruling in slavery.
Dred Scott?
Dred Scott case. That was a federal court. The state court, actually, he prevailed in. And it were the states that actually invoked personal liberty laws that allowed people to ignore the federal law in these things. So, again, it takes a very selective view of history to look at the federal government as your savior in these things. And what happened was, again, the people that were enforcing, they were coming up with these ideas, the think tanks and the bureaucracies, they didn't have the people's best interest at heart, just to say that. And that much is clear.
Of course. And since they didn't, there has to be some explanation for the behavior from this enormous political push. And how about just the obvious one, that it's the same thing that went on in the Soviet Bolshevik and in the Hungarian Cultural Revolution? I mean, this is just a very small clique that has the idea that they can take the mind of the European and basically blanket out.
Yeah, and these were the people that emigrated from Europe just before and during World War II, showed up at Columbia, showed up in Hollywood.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. And the thing is that they've created this very powerful tool of racism. This word, you know, like that just bulldozes reason aside. But hopefully, you know, intellectuals like Thomas Sowell and I think a new generation of African American intellectuals who have the value of what reality has been from these programs, right? They can, I mean, if you're like a young African American intellectual, like you're in your early 20s, like I hope that people like that are listening to the show, and you look out at the you know, the African American community and go, well, 85% illegitimacy rate, murder through the roof, the employment is like zero, money is coming in through illegal drug sales, federal government, basically we are pretty close to collapse as humans. How did we get here? And how do we get the hell out? You will cannot get out if you don't understand that you are being attacked. You can't simply take the position of like, well, let's try to change direction or let's try. Look, it's a weapon. It's a weapon that's damaging. And this is the same thing I would say to like a young white female going into university, say someone who's like 18 or 19. Look, you know, look at these things, analyze them as weapons. Study them as deliberate, not as accidents, not as bad social policy, because now we have seen where the kind of feminism that the CIA and Gloria Steinem created leads you. now we've seen where the weaponized welfare state, where it took the African Americans. We can see what happened. We can use reality to defend ourselves against people like Adorno with the song and dance, with the fancy language, you know, of like, the self is identifying with the bourgeois past and, you know, all of this nonsense. Look, folks, it should just be as clear as a bell. Just if you don't believe me, just take a drive through any city in America and see what really is going on inside our world. We are, as you know, humanity is great. And in spite of all of their attempts, there is still a really great nation here. But it is being attacked every single day. And we have to and this is one attack that we can't just fight with guns. We have to fight back with ideas. We have to show people that what the attack is made up of so that they can stop it from going on and prevent themselves from being destroyed.
Yeah, well, what they've done is they've created sort of this, pathological white guilt, and that again, disarms you intellectually and also morally, because people just feel guilty and they can't really articulate anything to defend the integrity of their ethnic group or the fact that there's such a thing. And again, there's power within that group in organizing and that such. That's just a natural way sort of to organize, and just effectively that's the only way really that you can really defend your freedom is if you organize. And if you don't organize on that basis, what do you organize under? Like under your Steelers fans or Bengal fans? I mean, come on.
Passed a sociology class. And, yeah.
I do think it's funny because this is sort of the hypocrisy that I see. I just observe, whereas I'll be at a cookout or a party or something, and people will start talking about some of these touchy issues. And, you know, the same way if you walk in the movie The Barbershop, where the black people in the barbershop talk honestly amongst themselves. The movie kind of was about that, what they really talk about when they're among their own kind, okay? And everyone can be honest with one another. Well, I hear a lot of, you know, there's a lot of talk about racial issues and a lot of white people being sick of being demonized and these things. And there'll be, someone who identifies more as a white identity or white nationalist or something. He'll start talking about people need a, you know, agency or communities to live with. There's nothing wrong with this. Other groups do this. Why can't we? And most of the white people will blanch at that and start thinking as a white separatist or a racist in these things. I'm not saying I necessarily agree with that policy, explicit policy. What I'm saying is their reaction is hypocritical, because most of these white people have the means and income to, again, implicitly segregate themselves.
Well, this is the funny thing.
They're living out what
this. You hear them like, and these. I know exactly what you're saying.
I mean,
if I ever was invited to a party, which I think the last one was 5 years ago, but if I was ever invited to a party, you'd hear these people talking about white nationalists, right?
Yeah.
And they're like, you know, talking about they're racist, they're horrible people, they're like bigots. And I'm just thinking to myself, hey, guys, we live here in Montecito. We have Oprah. But why did you pay $5 million for a $2,300 ranch house that's, you know, took $50,000 to build if this wasn't an important thing, right? Mm-hmm. It's just the hypocrisy is just it is really clear, because in people who have more money, they can really indulge themselves in their fantasies about themselves, you know.
Yeah.
Where we are multicultural. Yeah, we're really multicultural to live here with Oprah, you know. and so it's just ludicrous. The white nationalists or, you know, the people, you know, you what happens is the media will pick up on I mean, James Earl Ray, right? Mm-hmm. There's your white nationalist, you know. and so they'll demonize them. They won't put forward people who have that perspective that are trying legitimately to communicate, you know, that don't they. It's sort of like how they've demonized Muslims, mm-hmm. you know, by putting the most extreme, you know, kind of crazed jihadist as you know, yell in a screaming match with Sean Hannity, you know, and so, well, there it is, you know, this is what we're fighting against, you know, this craziness. Yeah. Well, these are just dramatic structures. And I think the white nationalists are, you know, they are like a Waco, David Koresh. But again, this is just an area where we have to overcome with critique of their motivation, right?
Yeah.
If we were critiquing the professors in the same way they critique our culture, they wouldn't last 5 seconds. Because, you know, it's like, really, we're not evil people when we just want to live within our own ethnicity. This is just a billion years of evolution coming about. We don't hate black people. They don't hate us. We just did real well with these ethnic neighborhoods. Now, the people who are trying to break them up, what is their motivation, Tim?
Mm-hmm.
Where is the real racism? Where is the real hatred? You see, so this is what has to get done, is that the population has to put critical theory, to use a phrase here, against the professors, against the left wing, well, not just left wing, because it's across both political, you know, the fake dialectic, but those that are trying to intimidate European Americans into accepting a class consciousness integrated world, right? And to feel guilty about, well, gee, I feel uncomfortable in this world. I really wish I had, like, when I was growing up and it was like a community where we all shared so many things, and that there was this political strength too that came from it. So the thing is, it's time now to turn critical theory against the professors. They are a sack of crap. They're just absolutely, you know, there's just so much evil and hatred inside of these people. And they, you know, they have developed sophisticated speaking techniques to, like, which are all based, you know, on like domination, like Noam Chomsky, this calm kind of, you know, like avuncular and senatorial, you know, sort of thing going on. It's just a lump of hatred. That's all that is inside of this individual. He knows perfectly well the truth about the things that he's lying about. He's okay with lying because of the hatred. So, you know, it's easy to expose them. We can then, when we do it, we can get rid of the intimidation, which is this. I mean, when you talk about the intimidation, the stuff that keeps people, you know, particularly European Americans from basically defending themselves. What they're really experiencing with the intimidation is the first steps of class consciousness. What they're really experiencing is the beginning of the voiding of their soul. Mm-hmm. That's really what that is. If we could just come to understand that this is our literal soul that has been voided out with these clever techniques. To basically expand us out into, you know, gender superficiality, and, you know, that doesn't matter. And I mean, these things do matter, and when we accept the fact that they do, and they matter to us, and we defend them, and we use critical techniques against the professors, we regain our soul, we regain our real person. We don't become filled with hate. We just aren't that kind of people. What we become filled with is ourselves.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, it's okay to be white. Right?
Absolutely.
And it's okay to be black, and okay to be Chinese, and, you know.
Not a physicist, though. I hate Asian physicists. I mean, I draw the line somewhere. I mean, that's it. I'm fine with, martial arts, but physics, no. I just get them the hell out of there. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is, it's just ridiculous. And it's just, you know, it's time to give up the intimidation, regain ourselves, and, you know, start telling the world what we are.
Well, also, there's a time and place for these things. There are some cities, particularly usually port cities or, you know, like New York or San Francisco, any city where it's going to have a sort of a cosmopolitan flair to it, and its delights and its threats, and you can have problems there. And there are also other interior communities that are going to be more homogenous. The problem is when you have the social engineers saying, oh, every place has to be the same in the name of diversity, and we'll start busing people, or we'll start putting Section 8 housing, and we'll have the federal government tax you to put a public housing unit in your neighborhood because we don't think it's diverse enough in these things.
Yeah.
So this is what's really going on here. So in the, under the natural order of things, you would, I think, without any social engineering, you'd have areas that would be homogenous and nationally, may I use the word, self-segregate, and there's nothing wrong with that, because that's how they identify. What we're pointing out here is a century of malicious social engineering,
yes,
psychological exactly. warfare, and we're all living in it, and we're all trying to unravel it and explain it now, because we're all kind of products. We're all been sort of been guinea pigs in this experiment. Now we're just our consciousness about it is raised. We're aware, we're pointing these things out. And all the good things they said they were doing for us, they were doing to us. And some of these oppressed ethnic groups, it's always been a question of something being done to them or something being done for them. Maybe it's time just to leave them alone.
I mean, everything that we've done to them since 1963
yeah.
has been, you know, basically mm-hmm. to destroy them, to because they were the most vulnerable. They were mm-hmm. the ones that were driven into class consciousness the deepest and the fastest. And that's really what's happening. When you look at the African-American consciousness and what has happened since 63, they're just the leading edge, the avant-garde of class consciousness.
Yeah.
And they have, when they sit there with rap music and are basically indulging themselves in the weaponized culture, then they are very close. They're basically losing their humanity one day at a time.
Yeah, they right? were there one time, the avant-garde, and then there was the feminists and the women, and then the homosexuals.
Right, exactly. And all of these things are going to be expanded. You know, the traits that were negative in the African American community that they could expand out. The traits, in the resentment that women naturally had against men, much of it was legitimate. I mean, so they expand these things out. Mm-hmm. It's critical theory. It's critique, right? It's just whatever it is you think is good, there is a dialectic. They just have the opposite, and then they will hammer it because they will say, well, look, you were saying that the free market is good, but look over here, there's an exploited class.
Mm-hmm.
They don't discuss the idea that there was positive things about this. They just bring up the fact that your own ideology is contradictory, right? And so then if they can, because they are can control the media, they can basically create a, you know, a snowball effect. And then the intimidation occurs, and then a little bit of the consciousness of the victim is gone, is done, is voided out, you know. But so this is I would say that this is something that is understandable to a lot of the young people who you know are seeing the results of all of this stuff. And they really need to start organizing among themselves education for the purpose of being able to apply critique against the professors. I mean, when you look at the professors at most of these universities, and I mean, again, I'm kind of blowing smoke because I haven't done that much analysis of, but I know the ones that are close to me that I've been able to actually see some of this stuff in action. I mean, it is just a cesspool. Every individual was selected to create a weaponized culture. I mean, you've got specialties that are so hideous. I mean, you know, that are like gender polysexualism in Marxist Europe. You know, I mean, these are their expertise. Every expertise is a weapon, it seems like.
And you go, and the students go into debt to learn this stuff.
And then they go into and then they need this degree, which is just insane. So anyway, you know, this is our role is to help organize, the students and also the civilians into learning how to apply critique against the professors, against the media talking heads that are trying to create greater intimidation inside you. Because we know now that the purpose of that is to void the soul and to basically create class consciousness for the purpose of slavery and genocide.
Yeah.
This is where it goes.
And in the final analysis, if a person who runs a bakery started it with his own capital, took the risk, built the business, and two degenerates come in and want a cake made for their so-called wedding, the business operator should have the right of refusal and say, no, thank you. Go find another bakery. And I'm sure there are plenty of other bakeries that they could have found. They shouldn't be dragged into court. It's ridiculous on its face.
Well, it's such a sad thing because like, well, why are these guys homosexual who come in and want to get married? I mean, this wasn't a you know there is it be, you know they talk about, well, we were all hidden, we were all in the closet. Well, I don't think so. I think it was just a biologically and culturally far more healthy environment. You see, they don't understand when they come in as gay men. They are already been victimized. The guy who won't give them the cake, he's not the perpetrator. It was the culture that took away their basic human sexuality. That's the problem. And they don't have this idea.
Yeah,
They don't
they're themselves
understand.
victims or refugees of the sexual revolution.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They need to apply the critical theory against culture, the culture and the environment, the toxic food, all of the things that damages our physiology. I mean, you know, it's the same thing that has reduced the sperm count by more than 50% is also part of, you know, all of these things, the toxicity, and is part of what the creation of the soy boy, that's the new, is been brought about by. The soy boy, is it's a term that women use in a negative way against males because they feel that males don't have any sexuality. And so this is a and it's in other words, this is something that's becoming so clear now in our culture that the women are creating terms to describe it,
Yeah,
right?
well, yeah, bisphenol A, no fathers, broken families, no support, no societal reinforcement of traditional masculinity. You're gonna get that,
You're going to get it. And when then you have vaccinations and plastic mimicry, petrochemicals in the clothing that gets into the bloodstream, and a thousand other things that I have no idea about, but it's all part of the toxic and cultural soup.
Yeah, maybe it's
That's
the silicone in the
I'll tell you,
McNuggets.
I am so fastidious about food, it is neurotic. I actually know the organic farmers. I mean, like when I mean, I've actually been to the farms, and I'm just going to tell you like a standard I have. If the farmer's dreadlocks are not at least 7 feet long, I don't want the food.
Yes.
I will sit there with my measuring tape and say, "Give me a piece of your hair. It's got to be at least 7 feet, because otherwise, I just don't think they're legitimate." For some reason, all of these like ancient hippies produce the best organic food.
Joe, you're discriminating.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, it works great because the food is good. But when you get a 7-foot-long piece of hair in your salad, it's a little off-putting.
As long as it's all natural. So, okay, Joe.
All right, brother.
Thanks.
Well, I think we've
Yeah.
given it a pretty good whack. So we'll get them next week, okay?
Thanks a lot. Have a nice
All right.
weekend,
Thank
man.
you, Tim.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.